trace some of my activities in presidential primaries and my effort to obtain the presidential nomination. In 1952, we in Minnesota were faced with a problem as to where our delegation would go in the presidential primaries. Estes Kefauver had come on the political scene contesting President Truman, and President Truman as yet had not declared his intentions as to whether or not he would be a candidate for re-election in the election of 1952. We in Minnesota were being pressured by friends of Kefauver and Kefauver himself for support, and there were indications that Estes Kefauver would enter the presidential primary. Truman was not going to enter, and was not going to enter any of the primaries, as a matter of fact. I went over to the White House and talked with some of President Truman's aides, including Charles Murphy and others, and the suggestion was made that if I would enter as a favorite son candidate in the Minnesota presidential primary, this might forestall Kefauver coming into the state. And even if he did, it might be possible for me to prevail in that primary with the understanding that the delegates would be Truman delegates. If I were successful in the presidential primary. This was a risky business for me. Truman was not particularly popular in 1952. In fact, his public opinion polls were very low. I was not a bona fide presidential candidate, and Estes Kefauver was. There was some support in our state for Kefauver, as there was in every state. If I were to file as a presidential candidate, I would have to make it very clear that I was only doing so as a holding action, pending the decision of Mr. Truman, and that if Mr. Truman were to declare for re-election, that I would release my delegates, if I were elected in the primary, to Mr. Truman. Now, all of this is very complicated for the voter. He prefers to vote for a bona fide presidential candidate rather than a stand-in. Stand-ins have had a very poor record, a very poor track record when it comes to presidential primaries. Nevertheless, I was very loyal to President Truman and wanted to see our state support him if he were to be a candidate. So I took the risk and permitted my name to be filed as a candidate for president in the Minnesota presidential primary. In the meantime, there were other primaries being held, particularly the New Hampshire primary, which Estes Kefauver won very handily. This added impetus to the drive on the part of some people in Minnesota to enter Estes into the primary. I had a frank talk with Estes and suggested to him that it would not help either our local political situation or himself if he were to enter the primary. Estes said he did not want to cause me any personal embarrassment or trouble, and that he would remain out, as he did. Well, of course, the presidential primary was a great, didn't turn out a particularly large vote, but larger than had been anticipated. I was the favorite son candidate of the Minnesota. We went to the convention in Chicago in July of 1952. By that time, Truman had declared that he was not going to be a candidate, and the contest was between Adlai Stevenson and Estes Kefauver. As a friend of Stevenson, I worked to see that our delegation committed its vote to him. I was in charge of the delegation, along with Orville Freeman. We shared the co-chairmanship of that delegation, and we delivered our convention votes for Adlai Stevenson. I recall that Adlai did not make it any easier for us during the summer of 1952. He was a very reluctant candidate. He indicated time after time that he didn't want to be a candidate. This was after Truman had declared that he was not going to seek re-election. Adlai sort of stayed at arm's length from Truman, which irritated the strong Truman supporters. But nevertheless, we committed ourselves to his banner, and we're, I think, some of Adlai's most loyal supporters, both at the convention of 1952 and in the post-convention period leading up to the election. Now, in 1956, the situation was very different. I did not seek to be a stand-in for anybody in that election. After some encouragement, we were able to get Adlai Stevenson to file in the Minnesota primary. And, of course, subsequently, Estes Kefauver filed. The top officers of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party of Minnesota, Ray Hemenway, our state chairman, Eugenie Anderson, our national committee woman, Orville Freeman, our governor, Carl Rovog, our lieutenant governor, myself, and Eugene McCarthy as United States senators, we were all for, myself as United States senator and Eugene McCarthy and as congressman, we were all strongly for Adlai Stevenson. In other words, the entire power structure of the DFL was in support of Stevenson's candidacy. Kefauver had some good people supporting his candidacy. Don Wozniak, a state legislator, and Peter Popovich, another state legislator, P-O-P-I-V-I-C-H, Wozniak, W-O-Z-N-I-A-K. These two men from St. Paul were in the forefront of the Kefauver movement. Robert Short, who had been active in the Democratic Party, had once sought to run for Congress, was assistant district attorney. He took up the banner of Kefauver. He'd always been more or less a maverick in our party, an attractive one, but a maverick. And he and Wozniak and Popovich, the three of them, were the trio that gave solid support and direction to the Kefauver campaign in Minnesota. Our campaign had to be conducted in the wintertime because our presidential primary was in the early spring. It was a miserable time for a campaign. Kefauver seemed to enjoy gumshoeing through the country, shaking hands. Stevenson never did. But Stevenson campaigned arduously in Minnesota, going through incredibly bad weather, going from one end of the state to the other, as did Kefauver. Stevenson and Kefauver put on a major battle out that way. All the odds were on the side of Stevenson because he had the power structure of the Democratic Farmer Labor State Central Committee. He had the support of Governor Freeman, who was popular and strong, and of our Lieutenant Governor Rovog and of myself. I had just been reelected to the United States Senate in 1954. There was every reason to believe that Stevenson would win. But as the results showed in each congressional district Kefauver was the victor and Stevenson the loser. Our delegation went to Chicago then, split. Part of it for Kefauver, the majority, and the minority for Stevenson. Now, the summer of 1956, leading up to the convention, was one of the most interesting ones in my political life. There was a great question and in Stevenson's mind whom he should have for vice president. And there's a considerable amount of discussion in the press about it. Kefauver and Stevenson were the two leading candidates for the Democratic Convention, Kefauver having more pledged delegates as a result of primaries than Stevenson, but Stevenson apparently stronger amongst the non-primary states. But the nomination was not yet sure for Stevenson, and there was serious doubt whether or not Stevenson would be able to deliver certain states. Therefore, the question of vice president was one that necessitated his attention. I recall a Democratic gathering in Washington in early summer, I think it was June of 1956, when we were raising funds for the Congressional Campaign Committee. That evening, Senator Walter George was our chairman. Lyndon Johnson had put his magic hand to the occasion and had been able to get George to preside as chairman, and had brought together the Southerners and the Northerners, the conservatives and the liberals, in a tremendous display of unity and strength at the at a Washington dinner. We raised a substantial sum of money, several hundred thousand dollars that night, for the congressional campaign committees of the House and the Senate. Just prior to this dinner, I had been talking with Adlai Stevenson on the phone, and he said he wanted to visit with me while he was in town for the dinner. We made arrangements to get together right after the dinner for an extended conversation. After the dinner, he talked very frankly with me about who he should have for vice, who he might look to as a vice presidential candidate. Bob Wagner, the mayor of New York, was being given consideration. Stevenson was Stevenson had made it clear that he did not want Kefauver. Apparently, the heat of the primary battles was still on his mind or affecting his attitudes. He showed interest in men like, as I said, Bob Wagner, Stuart Symington, Albert Gore. There were several others. I can't think of all of them. But and I spoke very frankly to him, pointing out their strengths and their weaknesses. And after we got all through with this conversation, Stevenson said to me, "Well, Hubert, why don't you think of yourself?" And I said, "Well, I appreciated that, but I just hadn't wanted to push my own self and the possibilities of myself, since I thought he was thinking of others." Well, he said, "I think you ought to think of yourself." I interpreted what Stevenson had to say as a go-ahead sign, feeling that he was interested in me as a possible running mate. He gave no indication that he was going to have an open convention for the selection of the vice president, that is, just to let nominations come from the floor and whomever came out on top that he would accept. But rather, what he indicated, as I understood it, was that if I could build some enthusiasm for my candidacy, that he could look with favor upon me and would be willing to take me as his running mate. Anyway, that's the way I interpreted his conversation. Present at that conversation was Max Kampelman, who sat with me during our discussions. I went back to my home state, met with Orville Freeman, Rovog, and other party leaders, told them of my conversation with Adlai Stevenson, and gave them my interpretation of the meaning of the conversation, namely that Stevenson was not for Kefauver. He had serious doubts about others. His only concern about me was whether or not I could get any support for my candidacy so that it wouldn't look as if he just pulled me out of the convention by his own power. Or in other words, if I could become acceptable to a number of delegates and the candidate of some others, that he would be able to exercise his prerogative as the nominee of our party if he were nominated, and suggest to the convention that Hubert Humphrey was the man that he would like to have on the ticket with him. Now, that's generally the way a vice president is selected. While the convention nominates him, generally the convention follows the request of its presidential nominee. Stevenson, however, decided at the last minute in Chicago in 1956 that rather than for he, Adlai, to make any suggestion or recommendation, that he would throw it open, as he said, a free choice of the convention for vice president. Well, this obviously meant that Kefauver started with a very large block of vote, since he had at least 300 and some delegates pledged to him for president. I had some delegations pledged to me. I had gone around the convention, had visited and appeared before many of the delegations. I believe I'd made a fairly good impression. I thought I had the support of George Smathers later on, of Florida. Later on, I found that George was really in support of Jack Kennedy. Stuart Symington nominated me for vice president, and it looked as if I had a reasonably good chance. When Stevenson left the convention, let the convention decide it, it meant that at least it meant that Kefauver had a leg up on everyone. Then, out of the Northeast came the name of Jack Kennedy, and Kennedy was placed in nomination, and the entire Eastern state bloc of the New England states backed him, which meant that he had a very substantial vote in the first ballot. Gore was nominated by the border state people, and Gore came in with around 150 votes or 40 votes, and there I was with my 130 to 140. And it became obvious that the battle was between Kefauver and Kennedy. Well, as I've indicated before, our delegation had a majority of Kefauver supporters, and I just couldn't see how we could turn the delegation over to Kennedy under those circumstances. I explained this later on to Jack Kennedy, citing the realities of politics, that the people of Minnesota did know Kefauver, that he had many followers in the agricultural areas of our state and amongst the farm groups. Since a majority of our delegation had already been committed to him for the office of president, it was necessary for us, when I saw that I couldn't get the nomination for vice president, to turn the vote over to ask our delegation to cast its vote for Kefauver, which I did. This indicates the story pretty well of the 1956 presidential primary. It was a smashing victory, a psychological victory for Kefauver. The fact that he could win in Minnesota, where the political power structure was all for Stevenson, gave Kefauver a tremendous play in the press and a psychological advantage. After the convention was over and Stevenson was nominated and Kefauver was the vice presidential nominee, I proceeded to set up in Minnesota the Stevenson-Kefauver Committee. I went ahead and raised most of the money for the committee, conducted the campaign in Minnesota as best I could, and tried to pull together the different segments of our party that had split over Kefauver and over Stevenson and Kefauver, and to get them to work as a team. I must confess that there were certain people in the Democratic Farmer Labor Party leadership that were so angry over Kefauver's victory in the primary that they hesitated to do a great deal of work for anybody in the general election. This kind of pouting and peevishness represents political immaturity. I made it very clear that I was for the Democratic nominee, and I was for Stevenson and Kefauver, and we went out and put on a campaign as best we could with very limited funds and resources, but at least we made a good showing. Now, from 1956 to 1960, It was clear that the Democratic Party was going to have to make a very basic and fundamental choice in the 60 campaign for the 60 elections, since Dwight Eisenhower could not run for re-election. It became ever more clear that the then Republican Vice President Richard Nixon had a hold on the Republican nomination and most likely would be nominated. At least that was the calculation of most of us. In the 1958 congressional elections, the Democratic Party won a major victory. The country was in an economic recession. The voters responded by voting against the Republicans and the administration, and sent to the Congress of the United States one of the largest groups of Democratic congressmen and senators since the days of Franklin Roosevelt. It was in this 1958 election that Gene McCarthy was elected, and there was a whole group of splendid liberal senators that came into the Senate. I had been very active in the campaign of 58 for a number of senators, and I recall that after that election, there was a Time cover story showing the Democratic potentials for 1960. And one that story included, that cover picture and story included names such as John Kennedy, G. Menem Williams, Stuart Symington, Lyndon Johnson, Adlai Stevenson, Hubert Humphrey, and one or two others. But I was prominently mentioned primarily because of my activity in Minnesota and the fact that Freeman had been reelected and that McCarthy had been elected, and that we'd had a substantial victory in our state. Likewise, we had picked up seats throughout the entire Midwest where I had been campaigning actively. I went to Europe immediately following that election, and I recall that when I arrived in London, that the Time correspondent was there to interview me once again, letting me know that at least I was being looked upon as one of the top potential contenders. I did give the situation a great deal of thought in 1959, in the winter of 1959, I met with a close political friend of mine and a wise counselor by the name of James Rowe. Jim had been one of the young Roosevelt, had been one of the young men in the Roosevelt administration. He was looked upon in Washington as a stable, thoughtful, progressive-minded Democrat, and he was indeed a good friend to me. We talked at length at my home one night as to whether or not I should consider being a presidential contender in the in 1960. Jim Rowe laid it out and said, if you're going to be a contender, you will have to run in the primaries. It's the only way that you'll get national attention and national recognition. You do not have a big enough national following and enough support within the ranks of the Democratic Party unless you take your case to the people and enter the primaries and win one or more of these primaries and thereby establish your credentials as a vote getter. This discussion took place in the early winter of 1959. We then proceeded to move around the country a good deal. I was traveling out particularly into the western states where I thought I might have some following, since I had visited in that area many times during my years in the Senate on public speaking tours, and campaigned all through California, Oregon, and Washington for Adlai Stevenson in 1952 and 1956. In the summer of 1959, I met in Duluth with some of my supporters, Governor Freeman and Karl Rolvaag, and we discussed at some length whether or not I should enter the primaries, the first primary being in Wisconsin, and if I were going to do so, I ought to start moving into that area as soon as possible and establishing a base of political operations. Our discussion was, I thought, inconclusive. It was my understanding that we were going, that I was going to feel my way around in, or I was going to move around in Wisconsin and feel out the political temperature, check to see whether or not it was possible to gain any substantial support, particularly from the labor movement, and then at the proper time, if it appeared that the conditions looked at all favorable, that we would make a formal announcement of my candidacy in the primaries. Well, things frankly just got out of hand, and I suppose no one is more at fault than I on this matter. But Freeman and Rolvaag, without too much consultation with me after that rather extended informal conference in Duluth, announced in the fall of 1959 that I was going to be a contender in the that I was going to enter the presidential primaries. Now, when you make an announcement like that in Minneapolis and St. Paul, you miss the Eastern press, you miss the impact of getting the impact of the Eastern electronic media. It becomes more or less a local announcement that gets a small sub-story in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the big press of the Eastern Seaboard and the Western Coast. This is something that is so fundamental to remember, that political announcements that are generated given out in the Midwest seldom make the same impact that they do if they are handled properly in the media centers such as New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and in the instance of politics, particularly Washington, D.C. It would have seemed, in retrospect, that what should have been done was for the role for Freeman as my chairman and Rolvaag, and Freeman and Rolvaag as co-chairman, for them to have come to Washington, called a major national press conference, having at that conference press, radio, and television, and to have announced that they were setting up a committee to support the candidacy of Hubert Humphrey for president. But as I said, the announcement was given out in the Twin Cities, and while it was quite a story at home, it didn't make much of an impact elsewhere. Anyway, I was in the battle. In the meantime, we had been feeling out things in Wisconsin, had set up a small operation, only to find out that it was in very immature and poor hands. The next thing I realized is that the office that we'd set up had been closed, that the telephones had been disconnected, that the bills were unpaid, we had little or no money. Well, I then moved into action and started to take a hand, and we put Gene Foley into Wisconsin to be my man there. Gene, having been a close friend in Minnesota, Carl Rolvaag started a fundraising operation in Minnesota. I'm happy to say that it did very well, particularly in the rural areas. We had people traveling the state with coupon booklets seeking contributions from every walk of life. We raised a very good sum of money, something around $50,000 to $60,000 or more out of that. But when you look back at it, $50,000 to $60,000 is practically nothing for a presidential primary. I had to spend my time trying to raise money in other parts of the country, in New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Seattle and Washington, D.C. But we traveled extensively, going up to Alaska and into the state of Washington, Oregon, and out into California, into Colorado and into all of the Rocky Mountain states, the Dakotas, and of course concentrating in Wisconsin. The battle in Wisconsin was a battle of contrast, so to speak. Kennedy was well organized. He had all the publicity that comes from a massive public relations campaign that was masterminded by competent people. He was young, attractive, with a pretty wife. He had his airplane. He was well financed. Just the fact that he traveled back and forth from Washington to Wisconsin by his own plane made an impact upon the the peoples of Wisconsin. It was different. It was high class. They put on splendid receptions that were more like social events than political rallies. And the Kennedy operation was well organized, well oiled, well financed, well publicized. Our operation was based primarily upon workers and farmers who were doing it their own way with limited funds and lack of good organization, and my own, depending on me a great deal for my own enthusiasm and campaign ability to get our message to the people of Wisconsin. I'm happy to say that I had the predominant, I had most of the labor movement in my corner, which meant that I was going to have considerable support from working people. I also had the Wisconsin Farmers Union and some of the farm cooperative people, which meant that I could do, would, should do fairly well in some of their agricultural areas. What we failed to calculate in Wisconsin was the conservatism of the Fox River Valley, the old Joe McCarthy area, and the fact that that area had predominantly ethnic groups of Catholic faith, and that I was looked upon in the area as far too liberal a person, and Kennedy was looked upon as a safer bet. There was an open primary as well. Republicans could vote in the Democratic primary, and there could be considerable crossover, as was indicated in the general election. For example, the vote that Kennedy received in the Fox River Valley in the primary was as big as what he received in the general election, and I think slightly larger. Well, the primary election in Wisconsin ended up with six districts being for Kennedy and four for myself. One of the districts in the area of Wausau was very close, and with a little more effort on our part, we might very well have carried it, thereby splitting the state. The Kennedy forces had felt that they would carry all 10 districts and at a minimum 8. The fact that I carried 4 and came close, very close in another, was interpreted by the national press as a psychological victory for me and anything but a convincing win for Kennedy. Prior to that primary election date, however, the press was, I thought, very definitely pro-Kennedy. I don't say they were anti-Humphrey, they were just pro-Kennedy. When, for example, Joseph Alsop, a distinguished columnist and a friend of mine, went into Wausau, Wisconsin, W-A-U-S-S-A-U, and his column read something like this, that he'd interviewed a number of people in Wausau and he hadn't found, I think he said he found 7 people that were for Hubert Humphrey, which was to say that I would be literally overwhelmed in the area. The primary results showed, however, that I carried the city of Wausau, Wisconsin. But this kind of early publicity made it look as if my case was hopeless and that the Kennedy campaign was faultless and was invincible. And I must say that in an election, the image that you are able to establish early has a great deal to do with the results that come later. Kennedy's image was one of a dynamic, charismatic young man that was on the victory trail. His image was one of a campaign that was exceedingly well organized and was producing phenomenal results. Actually, it wasn't all that good, but that was the way that it was sold. His crowds at meetings always appeared to be larger in print than in actual numbers. And there was a clever technique used to achieve this. One of the Kennedy public relations people would always be very close to a newsman, and by this time, the Kennedy man had contacted the local police chief or sheriff and would say to them, well, now, how many people do you think we have here today? Would you say 25,000, 5,000, or whatever the number was? And the sheriff or the chief of police look around and say, well, yes, I think so, and generally would give a little larger figure out of sheer parochial and local pride. This would be carried in the press as authentic. I can recall several meetings in which crowd estimates were at least double or more what the actual attendance was. But be that as it may, it worked. The psychological effect was just as they had hoped. It produced a feeling of invincibility and a victory for the Kennedy forces. I came out of the Wisconsin primary, however, somewhat encouraged. I had already paid my filing fee for West Virginia. The Wisconsin primary gave me political encouragement, but left us totally devoid of funds. In fact, we had bills outstanding in Wisconsin that were unpaid, and I had to proceed immediately into West Virginia if I was going to continue in the primaries. There was a considerable discussion as to whether I ought to continue. I must say that some of my political advisors, such as Jim Rowe, advised me not to, saying that they thought that I had done the best I could, that the time to withdraw was now, that I couldn't win. In the meantime, I was getting encouraging reports from some of the western states, and as time revealed, we did have a good body of support in the western states, with Washington and Oregon and Alaska and Colorado and Montana, Idaho, Utah. These states, many of them had pledged some of their delegates or all of their delegates to me. So I was not without support. I went there. I decided, therefore, since I had paid my $1,000 to enter the West Virginia primary, which, by the way, is a fantastic fee, I would go ahead. Mrs. Humphrey and our children had been very helpful in the Wisconsin primary. Muriel had worked her heart out and had demonstrated considerable skill as a campaigner. People loved her and responded to her message, her sincerity and her directness. When we went into Wisconsin or into West Virginia, we made it again a family affair. I remember having been down to, I believe it was the Greenbrier or Hot Springs, and after resting up a couple of days, Muriel took our Pontiac station wagon, and she and one of the boys went on into West Virginia. The station wagon was equipped with coffee and cups and cookies, so that she could set up on a street corner and talk and visit with people, and hand out literature and launch our campaign in that rather simple manner. Just as we had had to use buses in Wisconsin rather than planes, we used station wagons and cars in West Virginia. Again, I had some good help in West Virginia from some of our friends in the labor movement, but I found out later on that some of the labor movement had turned against me, or should I say went for Kennedy before the primary election date, which was May 10th of 1960. When we first went to West Virginia, the Kennedy forces released publicity to the effect that this was a state that Kennedy couldn't carry, but he hoped to do to make a creditable showing. In other words, to play the underdog, to make it appear that if he got 40% of the vote, it would be a remarkable achievement on his part. Polls were released by the Kennedy people indicating that I would most likely carry the state by a minimum of 65% of the vote. We had no such indication whatsoever. In fact, we had no money to take polls. But when we did go in, I found the people very receptive to my liberal progressive message. As a matter of fact, in no time in my public life have I found people who seemed to be more friendly, more willing to support me than in West Virginia, at least in the early days. And then the Kennedy juggernaut started to go to work. The publicity was fantastic, not only locally but nationally, and I was able to get very little national publicity. Kennedy was seen, pictures taken of him down in a coal mine with a coal miner's hat, off into a shack of a poor person in the mountains, visiting with workers in a factory or a steel mill. Incredibly good publicity. We had a debate in West Virginia. I thought that Kennedy did the better in the debate, primarily because the debate being televised, he looked very good, and when we got to talking about the hunger of people, he brought out food packages showing how little the poor people were receiving from the Eisenhower administration, and attacked the Republicans for their unwillingness to help people who were in poverty and people who were hungry. And just the fact that he brought out these particular food parcels, showing the cost of them for a family with no money, and also demonstrating what kind of commodities that were being made available by the government, commodities that were frequently unusable and surely did not present a balanced diet. I thought that that one clever stroke on his part put the debate over on his side. When it came to actual argument or statistical fact, I believe I did well or better. But the impact, as I would see it in looking back, would be that Kennedy came out ahead. Nevertheless, we were putting on a good campaign considering how little we had to do with, and believe me, we had little or nothing. I scarcely had money to get on the radio, much less television. In fact, I borrowed money from my brother and from my out in South Dakota. I wrote checks out of my own personal bank account to pay for television and radio time when we couldn't get credit. And I recall that the Democratic political organization in West Virginia seemed to be holding itself aloof. I was making little or no successful contact with them. They had what they call slating, which meant that the party apparatus put out a sample ballot throughout the state. And if you were on that sample ballot, it meant that you would do very well and most likely would come out victorious in a Democratic primary. I remember one time that Herbert Waters, who was working with me at the time in West Virginia, came to me with Gene Foley, who had also come over from Wisconsin, and said, look, the state committee wants $25,000 to slate us. Now, who they were talking to in the state committee, I don't know at this moment. It slipped my mind. But I said, we don't have $25,000. And even if we could get it, are we sure that they wouldn't be able to get more from the Kennedy forces? I believe that our committee did make a payment to the state committee, but as I indicated, and as I knew, it would mean nothing. It was just an extra contribution to the state committee that didn't get us slated at all. About a week before the primary, I was down in one of the cities of West Virginia for a banquet, and one of the Democratic leaders there called me aside and said, Senator, I think I should tell you, you have had it. In other words, you don't have a chance. The Kennedy forces have made their arrangements. Jack Kennedy is going to be slated. The organization is going to go for him, and this means that he shall win the primary. I understood that clear-cut language, and there was no doubt that what he was saying was the way it would be, because West Virginia Democratic politics lent itself a great deal to solid organization and to what we call slating. And Kennedy was slated. I was defeated overwhelmingly. I carried the city of Huntington, as I recall, where they had voting machines. In areas where they didn't have voting machines, we received a shellacking. I shall never forget losing communities where the black population was rather large and finding in precincts that we would get 4, 5, 6, 7 votes, and my opponent would get 200 or 300 votes. There were all kinds of things that transpired in that election that I'd prefer to forget. Later on, I found out, talking with the beloved Cardinal Cushing. In fact, he told me in the campaign of 1966, when I was in Massachusetts working for the Democratic slate in that state, he called me into his study, warm, and received me with great friendship and warmth. And we sat down along with others who were present, including Chubb Peabody, the candidate for Senate in the state at that time. Cardinal Cushing told me what had happened. And he said, you know, I keep hearing, keep reading about all these fellows that were supposed to have elected and masterminded Jack Kennedy's campaign. I hear that it was Pierre Salinger, or I hear that it was Larry O'Brien, or that it was Kenny O'Donnell, or it was somebody else. Well, let me tell you, as he said to me, the Cardinal said to me, let me tell you that it was none other than his father, Joseph Kennedy. He was the main brain, he was the main force and the brains behind the entire campaign. And he was willing to spend to elect Jack, and he was willing to use his influence to get support. And he proceeded to tell me how Joseph Kennedy would call on the telephone all around the nation seeking support for his son, how he would call his attorney friends who handled some of his accounts to ask them to organize committees for Jack Kennedy. And then he told me how they organized in West Virginia, working through, particularly through the smaller churches, giving contributions to the churches and giving contributions to little local groups, not very large ones particularly, because large money wasn't necessary, but just being friendly and charitable and generous and letting people know that, that this came from the Kennedy forces. I was amazed that the Cardinal should speak so frankly, but he did, and he let it, and he said that you'd be surprised, Mr. Humphrey, but or Vice President Humphrey, but you didn't have a chance in West Virginia, particularly when Joe Kennedy put his mind to seeing to it that his son was to be elected. The Cardinal made it very clear that the driving force and the most important personage in all of the John Kennedy operation was his father, Joseph Kennedy, and that nothing was spared to make his victory, to make Jack Kennedy's victory possible. The best talent was recruited, money was available, organization was built, and public relations of the finest quality. The West Virginia primary sealed up the nomination for Jack Kennedy. I withdrew from the campaign and proceeded to go back to my work in the Senate. Later on, as a matter of fact, I came back to the Senate the very next morning after the West Virginia primary. On the calendar was a bill that meant a great deal to me, since I'd worked on it a long time in the Committee on Government Operations. The bill was entitled Payments to Local Governments in Lieu of Taxes. This was a bill designed to require the federal government to make substantial payments to local governments as gifts in place of tax and taxes, since local government could not tax federal properties. The bill was had the broad support of had the backing and support of all local government organizations. When the majority leader asked me as to whether or not the bill could be called up, I said, how long do you, how much debate you expect? And he said, not a great deal. It appears to have clearance on the minority side, the Republican side of the aisle. I asked the question as to how long the debate might last and as to whether or not there was any opposition to the bill, because I was exhausted, having been up practically all night, having conducted a vigorous campaign in West Virginia, and having flown back the morning after the primary election. I arrived in the Senate just in time for the opening of the Senate. Tired, exhausted, and defeated. When the majority leader assured me that the bill would take only a little while, I said, we'll call it up and I'll handle the bill, since it was mine and it came out of the committee of which I was a member. The bill was called up for debate, what we thought would be routine action. At that point, Senator Carl Mundt of South Dakota joined the debate and proceeded to argue the case against the bill for several hours. I was literally exhausted, but refused to yield to him, and we carried out the fight during the day and passed the bill in the Senate. But believe me, I learned that the Senate is an unpredictable body. I also learned that sometimes it can even lack a sense of humanitarian consideration, because if ever there was a time that we needed some, that I needed some sympathy and understanding, it was on that date. I also was determined that despite my fatigue, I was not going to let Senator Munt or anyone else run over me simply because I was tired. It was a sort of test of will, and I'm pleased to say that we endured, that I endured. So ended the West Virginia primary. It was a valiant fight against a powerful organization. I saw what can happen in politics. I saw people change their loyalties. I saw certain leaders in the labor movement in West Virginia switch from my candidacy to Mr. Kennedy's. I saw the power of organization, of public relations, and money put to work. I'm not bitter. It just was a lesson that needed to be learned, and I surely learned my lesson the hard way. Following the West Virginia primary, I had several visits with Jack Kennedy. He talked to me in terms of my joining with him to forward his candidacy. I had reason to believe that he was urging me to run for the vice presidency, even though I doubt that there was any real, even though I doubt that this could have been pulled off. Kennedy did not need me as his vice president. He was sufficiently liberal to have the liberal vote. Having won in Wisconsin and West Virginia, he was sure to get much of the labor vote. These were vote blocks that I would have some attraction to, or that would be attracted to me. It was not necessary to have both of us be appealing to the same group. The Kennedy forces had put out feelers to a number of potential vice presidential candidates. Senator Jackson of Washington, Senator Symington of Missouri were two that were often mentioned. There were others that were being given, that were being talked about by the Kennedy forces. In fact, the Senator Governor Docking of Kansas had been mentioned. Governor Lovelace of Iowa. All of these thought that they were being considered for vice president. This was good, tough, smart politics. By a carefully placed inquiry and contact with these men, governors and senators that might be potential vice presidential nominees, the Kennedy forces started to nail down one delegation after another, because each of the men mentioned, such as Governor Lovelace of Iowa or Docking of Kansas, began to believe that they might be the one chosen, and surely they would want to show that they could deliver their own delegation. Orville Freeman of Minnesota was also talked to. And obviously, I had been talked to, not directly about vice president, but talked to in terms of joining with Kennedy in tying down his nomination, and also some indication that I would be on the ticket. I recall that I received a telephone call from Walter Reuther and from George Meany, separate calls. Both of them wanted to talk to me when I got to Los Angeles. Both of them in Los Angeles for the convention in July 1960. Both of them said that I ought to be the nominee for vice president. Both of them said they wanted to put their forces to work to get me the nomination. And they talked to Kennedy about it. I turned them down. I said that I didn't believe that I wanted to be considered for the job or for the office, that I thought that there were others that were already under consideration. I was still somewhat smarting. I was still smarting over the, and hurting over the defeat. But it wasn't so much that as it was the fact that I'd had sincere doubts as to whether or not I was really being given serious consideration. I didn't want to be played with or used. Muriel felt very strongly that I would be, that I was being used, and that if I indicated any desire to be vice president, that I would be added to the list of those who were tied in to a very clever political operation to secure convention votes. And she insisted that I not lend myself to it. I believe that she was right. I don't believe that I would have gotten the nomination, and I doubt that I was being given real serious consideration, even though my name was being bandied around and I could have been tied in very, and could have been tied down for some period of time, thinking I might have a chance. After the West Virginia primary, I did, however, introduce Jack Kennedy to a number of my supporters, particularly in the agricultural areas. For example, Jim Patton of the Farmers Union and Tony DeChant, DeChant of the Farmers Union, people from the National Milk Producers, the Grange, and others, where Kennedy did not have where Kennedy's credentials were not too good. I brought him in touch with John Baker, the legislative representative of the Farmers Union. He in turn brought John Baker onto his campaign staff and put Baker to work lining up campaign support. I've already discussed Kennedy's visit to Minnesota and the developments in the campaign from the time of his visit to the Minnesota Jefferson Jackson Day dinner until he received the nomination. Such was the 1960 effort. I learned a great deal out of that presidential bid in 1960. I learned that national politics requires more than just the candidate's efforts, the candidate's ability, or the candidate's stamina and enthusiasm. It requires, above all, a vast amount of money, and that is not accumulated quickly, nor can it be accumulated by any one man. It requires a national organization and an organizer or director of a campaign that understands national politics, the differences in the areas and the regions, someone who knows the principles or the individuals involved in state and national politics. I learned that if you're going to run in a national campaign, you need to know the governors, and you need to know the key legislative leaders. You need to know the movers and the shakers and the political organization in every state, if not in every state, at least in most of them. You need to understand the issues that are of deep concern and interest to the different parts of our country. I think I did understand that, maybe better than anyone. I was able to speak cogently, intelligently, and convincingly in areas like Alaska, the Pacific Northwest, the Southwest, the Midwest, yes, in all parts of the country. I understood their concerns, the deep concern in the Rocky Mountain states over the development of power, over irrigation, the deep concern in Alaska over the development of power and the extension of public works and the industrial development of that part of America. I think I understood the agricultural issues about as well as anybody, if not better than most. But the campaign of 1960 demonstrated that in order to really succeed, you have to plan a long ways ahead. Kennedy started his campaign immediately after his very impressive showing in the Democratic Convention of 1956, when he was receiving so many votes from the convention delegates for the office of nomination of vice president. From that day on, he proceeded to build carefully organization, to establish contacts throughout the country, to build a Kennedy following, to develop issues, and to concentrate upon issues that would have both national and sectional appeal, and also to guide himself with sufficient caution as not to be caught up in every issue that was too highly controversial and would lose votes rather than gain them. And the classic example of this is when he voted contrary to what was the so-called established liberal position on the jury trial for violations of civil rights. I've discussed this in another chapter. I also found out that you have to have power bases if you're going to run for national office, that you cannot just depend upon even good press or media or effective electronic media. You have to have areas of strength, such as Kennedy had in the New England states, in the Chicago area, in Los Angeles, and other areas where he could point to and know that these were solid constituencies that would stay with him in the convention. So the experience of 1960 was not a lost endeavor. It gave me information and knowledge that that stood me well in the years to come. Also, I helped develop the issues in 1960. I'm sure that I did as much as anyone to define the areas of concern of the Democratic Party for the campaign and the election of 1960. I know that by my addressing myself to the issues as I saw them, I helped define the platform of the Democratic Party. In fact, I believe that it can be said that the campaign between Kennedy and myself in 1960 did establish the platform planks of our party, and that platform was basically what I had been fighting for and campaigning on during those months of late 59 and the first 10 months of 1960. Kennedy developed in that campaign, he developed a broader understanding of issues such as conservation and irrigation and public works and public power and agricultural policy. None of these had he really given too much attention to as an Eastern congressman or senator. He became a much better informed candidate as a result of the primaries and a seasoned candidate. I was convinced that he would defeat Nixon. I said it was somewhat in jest and yet in fact that if Kennedy could defeat me, I knew he could defeat Nixon. And he was a much better candidate in September, October of 1960 than he was in the early months. I had given Kennedy his spring training, and he was ready for the main event when the time came. I also recall saying in the Wisconsin primary. I saw so many of the Kennedy family in Wisconsin that I felt like an independent merchant running against a chain store. In other words, wherever I looked, there was a Kennedy. There was either Rose Kennedy, Jack Kennedy's mother, or Eunice, or one of his other sisters, or Robert, or Ted, or Sarge Shriver. There was always somebody in some part of the state of Wisconsin. And no matter how much I worked or how active I was, and even with the help of my wife and one or more of my sons, we were surely no match for the team that the Kennedys put in the field. They outgunned us, outmanned us, outspent us, outorganized us. But we did a fairly decent job nevertheless, and was particularly in Wisconsin. But when you ran against the Kennedy combination and machine, you had your work cut out for you. Now, despite all of this, my relationships with the Democratic with Jack Kennedy, both as candidate and as president, were excellent. We seemed to hit it off very well together, And I have a feeling that Jack Kennedy made an extra effort to be considerate of me and friendly to me as a result of these primaries. I know that his staff surely was that way. When he became president, his key men of Larry O'Brien and Kenny O'Donnell, Ralph Dungan, these were three of his top men, were very close to me and always most cooperative. I had no complaint whatsoever from the manner in which the Kennedy staff at the White House treated me. On the contrary, they went out of their way to be helpful. I could talk frankly with them about the problems in the state of Minnesota, my concern about certain matters in the Senate, and whenever I made any reasonable request, it was honored. In fact, I recall that just prior to President Kennedy's death, I had reached an agreement with him on the establishment of certain laboratories in Minnesota relating to our NASA program, our National Aeronautics and Space Agency program. There were to be 10 of these laboratories established, and it appeared that all of them might go to the east. But I asked the president directly for some consideration for my part of the country. And as a result, he agreed that at least two of them would come into Minnesota. Likewise, I appealed to the president, to President Kennedy, to help us develop for the Midwest University Associates a huge atom smasher, a atomic energy installation for atomic research. It was to be established at Stockton, Wisconsin. That was the point that was agreed upon. It was highly controversial because the Atomic Energy Commission was not at all sure that it wanted to go forward with it. But again, the president said that it would be done. He did this out of thanks, as an expression of thanks and appreciation for my loyalty to him and my service to him, not only in the campaign of 1960, where we carried Minnesota, and that meant a great deal to him, but as one of his legislative leaders. When the very last meeting I had with President Kennedy was on the day that he left for his trip to Texas. And as he departed, I can recall walking back from the White House breakfast meeting back towards the presidential office, coming down that veranda or corridor out by the Rose Garden. And the president cut across the lawn and was going to visit with someone over by the door of his office. And I said to the president as he departed, I said, "Well, Mr. President, I gather now we have a complete understanding about the atomic research, the atomic research facility, and the electronic laboratories the NASA laboratories that we were talking about." And he said, "Indeed, we do, Hubert. They're all set." When Vice President Johnson became president, I took these matters up with him. And the new president said, however, he would have to take a look at them as a matter of a review of the budget, because there were serious budget problems. And I asked Kenny O'Donnell to come in and verify my understanding of my agreement with President Kennedy. And he did just that. He told President Johnson exactly what had transpired and of the agreement that I had. I regret to say, however, that the Bureau of the Budget and the Atomic Energy Commission prevailed, and we had to settle for less than we wanted, but we did get a research establishment, an expanded research facility at the laboratories in Chicago. The Argonne Laboratories, ARGONNE Laboratories in Chicago. Laboratories that would accommodate Midwest research, Midwest scientists in the field of physics and atomic energy. So we made some progress. When it came, however, to the laboratories under the NASA program, these we did not get. And I felt very badly about it, because this had been a very important matter to me. But again, the NASA agency under Jim Webb and the Bureau of the Budget decided that these laboratories would not go to the Midwest, but rather would go to the Eastern Seaboard and to Texas, and I guess some into California. But wherever they went, we didn't get them. I only cite this because President Kennedy went out of his way on several occasions to be of help. For example, he did ask me to handle legislation such as the Peace Corps, and he put in the bill as we wanted it and sent it over as an administration message. He did put in the bill on the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and asked me to take the lead and permitted me to be the main sponsor of the bill. Let me just digress a moment to say that the arms control legislation, the legislation designed to establish the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, came at a time which seems almost incredible when you understand the circumstances. It was in 1961, and the Russians were again bringing pressure to bear on Berlin. President Kennedy had to call up a substantial number of American reserves, I think something like 200,000. An additional 50,000 troops had been sent to Berlin in the summer of 1961. Indeed, Kennedy had gone there himself and had made that famous speech of his and said, "I am a Berliner," which, of course, endeared him to the hearts of the people of West Berlin as no other president has ever been able to do. When he returned, I had been pressing for the consideration of the legislative proposal that I had to establish an arms control and disarmament agency. Now, here we were calling up additional troops and actually having to spend more on our Defense Department. It seemed like a contradiction to even consider an arms control agency. But on the contrary, I felt, and the President came to feel, that while it was necessary for us to maintain our strength, military strength, it was also necessary for us to look ahead, to see to look to the day when we could pare down and when we could lower the level of armament. But we had to do this within the confines of our total diplomacy and national security policy, that arms control and disarmament was a matter of national security, and it should not be dealt with outside of the channels of national security. So when the president gave me an opportunity to present my case for the proposed legislation. He invited me over to a lunch, and prior to the lunch, we went swimming in the White House pool. I'll never forget it, because the pool was kept very warm, Kennedy needing exercise for his back, and the doctor, I guess, prescribing very warm water for his swimming. And I recall coming out of that pool like I'd been in a Turkish bath or a sauna. And all the time that we were swimming in the pool, we were talking about whether or not this legislation should be offered at this time, and whether or not it had any chance to be passed. I said to the President that I thought we could get it through, but I did know, above all, that it would be good, solid politics, both domestically and internationally, politics in the best sense of good, solid public policy, for him to present legislation to broaden the scope of the State Department and of the Defense Department to include, as a matter of our overall international policy for national security, an arms control program. There surely was nothing to be gained in an arms race except more trouble, increased expenditures, and more dangerous weapons. And whatever we did in arms control, or hopefully in some program of phased disarmament, we ought to do carefully and methodically, that it ought to be tied into our overall international policy and not be something that was dealt with separately and distinctly away from the broad national security considerations. The president listened and agreed and said, well, go ahead, I'll send up a message and you introduce the legislation. I did so. And once again, may I say that I had the privilege not only of introducing the legislation, but of conducting some of the hearings and being the floor leader for the bill. This particular piece of legislation did not have enthusiastic support from many members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I must say that Senator Fulbright and Senator Aiken, both of them, and Senator Hickenlooper, all three, looked with askance upon this proposal. I sometimes wonder how I even got it out of committee. Amendments were made, but we were able to maintain the autonomy of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, placing it within the administrative jurisdiction of the State Department, but having the director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency appointed directly by the President and confirmed by the Senate, and only for administrative purposes, that is, housekeeping purposes, was the State Department to have any direct control. However, there would be director of arms control would report directly to the President of the United States, also to the Secretary of State and to the Congress. So we won our battle. It was a close fight. There was one amendment, I recall, that we won by just one vote. That amendment that we defeated by one vote. That amendment was offered by Senator Goldwater to deny the Arms Control Agency the right to do independent research in the field of arms control. Had we lost that battle, the Arms Control Agency would have become primarily a public relations or propaganda vehicle rather than having any muscle or any substance or having the possibility of standing on its own in arguing with the Defense Department and the State Department and the Central Intelligence Agency. After all, the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency had to make evaluations of weapon systems as well as have its input on foreign policy. So it was of the utmost importance that that particular agency have independent means, an independent budget, the right to do independent research, that the director, while coordinating his activities with the Secretary of State, was not to be under the direction of the Secretary of State, nor under the direction of the Secretary of Defense, that the Director of Arms Control and Disarmament would report directly to the President and would have a direct communication with the President. This was a singular achievement, and none of it, I must say that to have that legislation passed at the very time that we were in a critical international situation indicates that things can be done if you put yourself to it. I was well prepared for this debate and for this legislation, having served as chairman for several years of the Disarmament Subcommittee. When Vice President Johnson succeeded President Kennedy and became our president, on his return to Washington from Dallas, on that very first evening, Muriel and I saw the President and Mrs. Johnson, and Mrs. Johnson said to Muriel, Muriel, we're going to need you and Hubert. We made arrangements the President said to me that he surely would like to talk to me, but he was going to go home. It had been a terrible day, and he would be in touch with me. As I recall, it was the next day that the President spoke to me and asked if we could stop out to the Elms, the home of Vice President Johnson and Mrs. Johnson. We went there for an evening of visit and consultation. One other meeting that had taken place either on the night that the President came in or within the next day was a meeting with some of the leaders, the Democratic leaders of the Congress. The President called together the Speaker, Carl Albert, Mike Mansfield, myself, George Smathers, and others, and said how much he needed our help, and that he was determined to carry through President Kennedy's program. that he wanted us to pledge to him that we'd give him everything that we could to get that job done. He was a man that was obviously very upset and deeply concerned and much and filled with sorrow over what had happened. I mention this because President Johnson was determined, as I found in the days following President Kennedy's funeral, determined to get every item of President Kennedy's program before the Congress and to get action upon it. I worked very closely in those days with the President to get that done. And I recall that before President Johnson announced his candidacy for election in 1964, he had been able to say with truth and sincerity that he had carried through his promise to President Kennedy, the promise that he had made to the departed president, that his program would be law and would be carried out and made part of our national policy. I recall so distinctly working with President Johnson and Jack Valenti on the speech that the President was to give to the Congress, the first speech after President Kennedy's death. I recall some of the phrases that we worked over, and I felt it a great honor to be included in that historic, to be included as an advisor in that historic document and in that historic moment. In the coming year of 1964, there was a great deal of talk immediately as to who would be, as to whether or not President Johnson would run for election number one, and if he did, who would be his vice presidential running mate. The news media, of course, starts the talk about these things right early. I think that if we'll examine the press, that it can be said that the talk about the vice presidency was the major political news of the first nine months of 1960. It was presumed that President Johnson was going to run for re-election, even though since his leaving the presidency, there's been considerable information that he had some doubts as to whether he would seek election in his own right in 1964. Mrs. Johnson has written in her diary that the President was uncertain, in fact had almost decided not to seek election, that she had encouraged him finally to do so, that she felt he had a duty to do so, and it wasn't until in the late summer of 1964 that President Johnson actually made up his mind that he was going to be a candidate for election. Nevertheless, the press just assumed that he was, and therefore the attention on the presidential scene, insofar as the presidential politics was concerned, centered around who would be Mr. Johnson's running mate, who would be the candidate for vice president, and that started right early. And I can recall that there was a number of columns written that Hubert Humphrey looked like a real good possibility. Then there were others, of course, Bobby Kennedy and Sarge Shriver, Mike Mansfield, Eugene McCarthy, Stu Symington. The vice presidential guessing game was in full bloom by the early summer of 1960. I had a talk at one time with President Johnson about this in the most general terms, but I should say for the record that we did visit sometime, I believe, like in the month of May of 1960. When he indicated to me that if he could have his way, that I would be his choice. But he indicated also that it isn't always easy for a president to have his way, that there are other factors that have to be considered. So what he said in substance was that on a man-to-man basis, and insofar as personal relations were concerned, I was his choice. But that he was also president and he had to take into consideration political considerations. And that left the whole matter of the selection of the vice presidency very much open. I never told anybody about this conversation, not even my closest intimate friends. because I felt that this was something that was between the president and myself. But I did know that if he felt that way, that all I needed to do was to try to make myself politically acceptable to the president and to a number of people that the president would need for support. And one of the areas where I had my strength was in the labor movement. And it is, I suppose, one of the most convincing statements that was ever made to the president about the vice presidency. It was when George Meany went to the White House sometime in early August and told the president in no uncertain words that their candidate and their only candidate was Hubert Humphrey. I know that President Johnson had a very high regard for George Meany, and the fact that the president of the AFL-CIO would make that statement in unequivocal language made an impression. There was a move mounted, as we all know, for Robert Kennedy. This was not only a move that gained great attention in the press, and actually the press helped, I think, build the movement. But there were the Kennedy forces, so to speak, were moving to insist that President Bobby Kennedy be taken on as the running mate for President Johnson. The president ended this speculation by saying that no member of his cabinet would be considered. Rather than to say that Bobby Kennedy wouldn't be considered, he just stopped the whole thing by saying that no member of his cabinet would be considered, and that ended the speculation on Bobby Kennedy. Insofar as whether or not Johnson would select him, there still, however, was a move on foot to place Bobby Kennedy's name in nomination, whether the president liked it or not. That, however, lost some of its steam as the convention came, as convention time came on. It's very difficult for it's difficult, if not impossible, to nominate someone for vice president if the presidential nominee is bitterly opposed to him or says no. And the president had made it clear that the answer was no, and so far as Bobby Kennedy was concerned. Then there was some talk about Sarge Shriver. And in all of these discussions about who might be the vice presidential nominee, the hand of Lyndon Johnson was, while not conspicuous, was surely there. President Johnson was keeping the political interest alive in himself and in the Democratic Party by, I think, tossing into the hopper from time to time names of potential vice presidential nominees. This gave the press something to work on, to chew on, to talk about, to write about, for the commentators to talk about. And after a certain run and period of time, then the president would let slip the name of another person. I saw this happen in the instance of Sarge Shriver, of Eugene McCarthy, which, by the way, was, I think, a much more serious move than just a talk, than just a suggestion. I saw it in the instance of Mike Mansfield, where the president let it leak out that Mike was being given consideration, even though Mike promptly said that he would not consider it and would not take it, even if it was offered. Nevertheless, President Johnson, a shrewd politician that he is, kept the interest alive in the presidential politics of 1960, not so much by having any doubt as to whether he would run, that is, public doubt as to whether or not he would run, but rather public doubt as to just who would be the vice presidential nominee. So that the vice presidency took on added importance in the summer of 1960, much more importance than would ordinarily come to it. I don't recall of any time in recent years, since 1944, that there was as much interest in the vice presidency. In 44, it was between Wallace and Truman, but even that interest was primarily at the convention. Actually, in 1960, the interest in the vice presidency started in the early months of 1960 and continued all through the spring and the summer, up until the very convention time, when the president made known his his thoughts and feelings and his recommendation.
Well,
there's a basic error in all of this transcription. I keep using the year 1960. When it comes to the vice presidency, this year should be 1964. So let's correct all the way through the transcript, the year 1960 to 1964, insofar as Johnson as president, Johnson with the vice presidency. Also, I want to add another name in the consideration for the vice presidency, and that's Robert McNamara. McNamara had a peculiar hold on President Johnson. I recall President Johnson telling me that he thought that Robert McNamara was the most able and intelligent man that he'd ever known. He felt this way during the time that he was vice president, as well as in the early years of his presidency. And in 1964, I think it is fair to say that President Johnson did have in mind Robert McNamara for the vice presidency. The problem was that McNamara had no support in the Democratic Party, amongst the Democratic professionals, the party leaders, the labor leaders, and those who would really be at the convention. It would require a major effort on the part of President Johnson to get the nomination for McNamara, particularly if somebody were to contest it. And there was the possibility that that contest would surely take place. But in 1964, outside of Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy, the other most prominent name that was bandied about in the press for a considerable period of time and with considerable merit and credibility insofar as being a potential nominee was Robert McNamara. But Bob McNamara's trouble was that he had been a Republican and then an independent, and while he was while he had been selected by Kennedy as his Secretary of Defense, McNamara had never shown his Democratic credentials. In other words, it's one thing to be a Secretary of Defense with considerable acclaim and prominence, to be a friend of a president. But when you go to the Democratic Convention, you better be a Democrat. Democratic conventions seldom nominate people who have just had recent conversion. They like people who have been in the church for some time.
Oh, that's good.